Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palka reporting. Dallas, Texas, moving forward. Leaders in Southern City of Dallas, Texas, are encouraging citizens to unite and move forward past the tragedy of losing five police officers at the hands of a lone gunman who targeted white policemen because of his rage over the recent killings of two black men by police. This is Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings.
You know, we're all human here. And I think that people feel each other's pain. And that's what makes it great. That's what makes you hopeful that we can do this, that we can move from senselessness, absurdity, that's like a Camus novel, to something that has redemption and hope in it.
U.S. President Barack Obama is calling on Americans to mutually respect their fellow citizens. The president said violence against police by anyone concerned about fairness in the criminal justice system does a disservice to the cause. President Obama is seeking to reassure Americans that the country is not divided. He made these statements yesterday before he left the NATO summit in Warsaw, Poland.
The demented individual who carried out those attacks in Dallas, he's no more representative of African Americans than the shooter in Charleston was representative of white Americans, or the shooter in Orlando or San Bernardino were representative of Muslim Americans. They don't speak for us. That's not who we are.
The president is due back in Washington Sunday night. Demonstrations about police brutality against black men continued around the U.S. into the night Saturday and early Sunday. Days of protests began in response to police shootings last week of the two men, one in Louisiana and the other one in Minnesota. This is VOA News. Now, President Obama had to cut his trip to Europe short because of all the tragedy at home. He managed to fit in a visit very quickly to Spain and their monarch, King Felipe VI.
I wish I was staying longer, and I'm so grateful for the understanding not only of His Majesty, but the people of Spain. We've had a difficult week back in the United States, so my trip is a little abbreviated, but I thought it was very important for me to come here, given the extraordinary friendship and alliance that exists between Spain and the United States.
Earlier, the president had reminisced to the king about a trip he made some years ago to Madrid.
I confess, though, that the first time I came to Madrid was not on Air Force One. I was about to enter into law school. I had a backpack. I traveled by foot most of the time and ate very cheaply.
The president's trip to Spain was abbreviated so that he could accept the invitation of Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings to visit Dallas this week. Gunfire has erupted again in South Sudan's capital following days of violence between rival factions that left more than 100 people dead. Witnesses in Juba say shots rang out in parts of the city Sunday as former rebels and government troops exchanged heavy gunfire. Spokesmen for President Salva Kiir are blaming the oppositional forces of Riek Machar. In the meantime, Machar's spokesman says the president's forces fired first at the first vice president's residence. Earlier, the U.S. State Department issued an urgent call for calm in South Sudan after the deadly fighting began on the eve of the fifth anniversary of the country's independence. NATO's military operations commander says North Korea's latest missile test is a serious threat to the Pacific region and the globe. U.S. General Curtis M. Scaparotti, NATO's supreme allied commander in Europe, said that the Kim Jong-un regime continues to work on its ballistic missile capability and is getting better at working out its problems. The North conducted a submarine missile launch late Friday, which reportedly failed. Prominent Cambodian political activist and commentator Khem Lay was shot dead in broad daylight while sitting in a coffee shop at a gas station in Phnom Penh on Sunday. The popular public figure was an outspoken critic of the government and the founder of the Grassroots Democracy Party. His killing has intensified growing public outrage at the government of Prime Minister Hun Sen, with a large crowd of protesters at the scene convinced that this was just the latest act in a wave of government intimidation of opposition politicians. Joe Palka reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
Yesterday, the 9th, the day was okay, but this morning, the same SPLA-IO forces attacked the position of our checkpoint in the western part of Juba. They are attacked and captured.
South Sudanese President Salva Kiir calls for a key meeting with two of his vice presidents Monday.
We started the process and we announced that we would be rationalizing staff in March this year. And we have just started the first phase of that rationalization, which is really about trying to focus on improving productivity, but also right-sizing the business.
Kenyan Airways plans to lay off about 600 employees.
There is a provision under the law where we can amend the campaign timetable. If we consider the environment not conducive for a free and fair election, we are at liberty to amend the election timetable, which includes the period for campaigns.
And the Electoral Commission of Zambia suspends political campaigns in the capital Lusaka and Namwala following escalating violence. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South Sudanese Information Minister says President Salva Kiir has invited First Vice President Dr. Riek Machar and Second Vice President James Wani Iga to a meeting at the Presidential Palace on Monday. Michael Makuei says the top government officials will discuss the latest clashes that left over 100 people dead and many injured. He told me troops loyal to Dr. Machar are to blame for the violence.
The suspicion is that the forces of Riek Machar came from there with 20 cars plus his car, 21. That was an abnormal force that was brought, and that was the immediate suspicion. That why should he come with all these forces by this time? Now the officer who came and caused all this confusion came there after in an ambulance, and he was told that you are not part of the escort of the first vice president for today. Why did you come? But because this man came with maybe a preconceived plan, he immediately stopped one of the presidential guards of President Salva. And as a result, a fighting immediately erupted within the presidential palace and the surrounding of the presidential palace. This is what happened.
So what happened to the soldier who started shooting a confusion?
That military officer who shot the presidential guard was immediately shot. He was the second person who died after that soldier whom he shot.
So what is the current situation there as we speak?
Well, after that, President Salva intervened, and of course the guards of the first vice president were repulsed, and they were all sent out, with most of them sustaining very heavy casualties. And thereafter, Dr. Riek was left alone, and the president intervened and protected him and ensured that he's taken back to his base safely. And the president organized a special escort for him from his presidential guards to escort Riek Machar up to his residence. This was on the night of the 8th. You see, this was on the night of the 8th. Yesterday, the 9th, the day was okay, but this morning, the same SPLA-IO forces, the opposition forces, attacked. And let me repeat, attacked the position of our checkpoint, a checkpoint in the western part of Juba. That is on Juba Yei Road. They attacked it and captured it. This happened at a time when the people were already in their churches. So very serious. The SPLA had to move in to address that situation.
So what are you going to do? What are you going to do about the situation now?
The situation is under control. The government is in full control of Juba as of now. And we will thereafter see what will be the way forward. But the forces of Riek Machar, that is the IO forces, had been in flagrant violation of the agreement. There is no doubt about that. And this is very clear. They are the ones who ignited the fighting in J1 in the presidential palace. And they are the same people who are now, who today, who this morning caused another problem. We are here to ensure that things move well, peace prevails, and the people of South Sudan are properly protected. And the government is under duty to protect the people of South Sudan, not allow the rebels to continue violating the agreement, causing unnecessary havoc to the people of South Sudan.
What is going to happen next now that the situation is under control? What's next?
The situation is now under control, and the President of the Republic has already informed Riek Machar that they meet tomorrow, Monday. So then they discuss this situation and they chart out the way forward.
Michael Makuiz, the South Sudanese Information Minister, he spoke with me from the capital, Juba. Meanwhile, for a reaction regarding comments by South Sudanese Information Minister Makuiz, I reached James Gadet Dak, spokesman for Dr. Riek Machar.
It doesn't make sense for him to be calling for a meeting on Monday when he has not stopped his forces from attacking our headquarters and the residence of the first vice president. First of all, he has to tell his forces to stop the attacks, and then we see if the situation can allow for a meeting on Monday.
They said the situation is under control. However, there are reports that Dr. Riek Machar's house attacked. It has been dismissed as not true. What is the situation, if you can tell me?
I think they said what happened in the morning did not happen, then they are not telling you the truth. From 8 a.m. in the morning today, their forces, President Salva Kiir's forces, attacked the residence of the first vice president and the headquarters of his forces. The fighting took place, and they used helicopter gunships, they used tanks, they used heavy artillery. Many people have been killed, and the fighting has been continuing up to now in pockets of the capital. So if they are denying that, I don't know which truth they will really reveal.
Michael Makuiz blames troops from the SPLA-IO, your forces, for beginning these hostilities or these clashes.
I think it is not about 21 cars or how many forces or soldiers the first vice president could move with if there is peace in the mind of the president and his people. The number of people going with the first vice president would have been a problem. Actually, the number he went with is not that big compared to the presidential guide which the president had at the palace. So the problem is, who started the fighting? So it was the president's guide who shot the first bullet. So did they shoot the first bullet because of the number of the guides which the first vice president brought with him? I think that they should not have been the reason, because if the first vice president came for a meeting, and even if he came with 70 or even 100, and who did not provoke anybody, I think the border guys of the president should not have started the war because of that reason, of the number of border guys.
We understand that troops from the SPLA-IO also attacked a convoy of some envoys, and that the situation really is to be blamed on you for trying to undermine the full implementation of the recently signed peace accord.
This is not true. If I take you back to the genesis of this problem, it was on Saturday last week. It was the President Kiir's military intelligence personnel who assassinated, or actually directly attacked our officers, killing two of them without any provocation. So that was the beginning of the problem. And then they started to deploy their forces, establishing illegal roadblocks on Gudela Road, which is the road which the first vice president uses between his office and his residence. So they established those illegal roadblocks and stopping cars from our side, and then sometimes even taking the cars by force. And then on Wednesday, they stopped our soldiers who were taking food to their colleagues who guide the office of the first vice president in the center of the town. On their way back to the residence of the first vice president, they stopped them and demanded them that they hand over their weapons and that they should be arrested. And when our forces resisted the illegal arrest, they fired on them. And this resulted in the killing of five soldiers from the president's bodyguard or protection unit. And then on Friday, they called the first vice president to come to the palace for a meeting. The first vice president came, and then as the meeting was taking place, another huge force from the president came from nowhere to the palace and joined with his protection unit, and he started to fire on the at the first vice president's bodyguard. And this resulted in the fighting that took place at the palace on Friday. So this morning, they went to Jebel, a place called Jebel, where the residence of the first vice president is, and they started to attack our forces there. So they should not deny it.
James Gadet Dak is the spokesman for the South Sudanese First Vice President, Dr. Riek Machar. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Burundians' ruling party, the CNDD-FDD, says that the Arusha dialogue with the opposition is not about helping citizens, but rather promoting the self-interest of politicians. For VOA, Moses Havyarimana reports from the Burundian capital, Bujumbura.
The inter-Burundi dialogue that has been going on for almost a year now without success, the most recent round of talks took place in Arusha, under the mediation of former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa. They are expected to resume within the next week. At one time, the government held the process, but now the ruling party spokesman says that the dialogue will not likely produce tangible results. Jelaz Ndabirabe is the spokesman of Burundi ruling party, the National Council for the Defense of Democracy, Forces for the Defense of Democracy. He's critical of the Arusha agreement that ended the civil war 15 years ago. It aimed to promote reconciliation by creating a system of quotas and power sharing between the Hutu majority and Tutsi minority. For example, the military would be shared equally by the two groups, while in other institutions, the Tutsi would receive 40%. The government says that current negotiations are based on politics, not ethnicity.
The so long awaited truth will not come from Arusha. The situation is here worsened by the fact that the clergy was represented in Arusha 2000 in the ethnical debates that have led to the power sharing between ethnics, whereas they knew very well that ethnics were nothing but the products of the colonization.
Last year, President Pierre Nkurunziza was re-elected to a third term in the office. The opposition said the Arusha agreement provided only for two terms. Protests and political assassinations followed. The ruling party said that the only way to end the current crisis was through Inter-Burundi Dialogue Commission, which is supposed to provide a voice for all Burundians. But the opposition says it's not possible to have an inclusive dialogue because the commission was named by the president himself. Critics say most members, including those from the religious community and some from other political parties, are sympathetic to the government. Now, Mr. Ndabirabe's comments seem to imply the ruling party is losing confidence in the Arusha negotiation.
That population cannot go to Arusha since it is a seat for self-interest and political speculations without the people's interest for which the accord would be reached.
The dialogue was set to resume on July 12th, but it's been postponed once again by the former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa, who is mediating the talks. This comes after the opposition in exile complains that it has not been invited. Pancras Chimae is the spokesman of the Belgium-based group called SINARED, the National Council for the Respect of Arusha Agreement for Peace and Reconciliation in Burundi.
I think that he's doing his best so that everybody can be around the table. The reason why they postponed the meeting is just maybe more time to sort out that issue. It's not up to Bujumbura to choose who will be around the table or not. Because Bujumbura is one of the parties in that conflict, so he has no right to choose who will be there or not.
The government of Burundi says it doesn't recognize the group, which it says includes many people who participated in a failed coup last year.
The most important thing, just the result we are looking for. We are looking for just the ceasefire and the peace in our country. Because today we have no peace, because we have people who are in camps, who are refugees all over the world. This is not good. We have people in jail. We have people who have been killed. It's really important to have everybody around the table. Civil society, CNRED, member of the Catholic Church, whatever. All those people, we need their input so that we can have a good result.
The International Crisis Group, an independent organization committed to ending conflict, says dialogue between parties today should discuss any problem linked to the Arusha Agreement signed 15 years ago. The group says today's talks also need to address the most obvious challenges, including an end to violence and hate speech and the disarmament of militias, especially the Imbonerakure of the ruling party. And it says conditions must be created for the return of refugees. But at this point, it's not clear when the Inter-Burundi dialogue will resume or whether its participants can agree on the agenda. Also, the opposition is divided. Some want the whole CNRED Council to be included in the talks, but a few individual members who have been invited say they are planning to participate. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Kenyan Airways has commenced its staff rationalization exercise with 80 staff set to be affected in the first phase of a redundancy plan that could see 600 employees retrenched. It is laying off the employees as part of a cost-cutting measure to return to profitability. For more, viewers Abdul Shakur Abud reached Kenyan Airways Managing Director and CEO Mbuvi Ngunze.
We started the process and we announced that we would be rationalizing staff in March this year. And we have just started the first phase of that rationalization, which is really about trying to focus on improving productivity, but also right-sizing the business.
So what's the process? Are you going to be firing all the 600 or are they going to be sent somewhere else? And how are they going to be compensated?
Our announcement around the right sizing was two-faced. We said we will have redundancies, pure redundancies, but also we will do redeployment, and we said up to 600. And there is also, in terms of what the compensation process is, it's well-defined within our existing CBAs as well as the payments for the management staff.
Apart from the layoff, what other plans are you doing to really be able to get back to profitability?
We have a clear plan which we call Operation Pride, which has initiatives of over $200 million, both revenues and costs. Only 10% of the total program relates to staff rationalization. The rest is in terms of initiatives to grow the top line, but also to reduce the costs as we seek profitability.
Kenya Airways is one of most famous airlines in East Africa, in Africa as a whole, in the world. Can you explain what are the causes of the economic downfall?
I would say we are not unique in terms of our profitability, the fact that we are in losses. What we see within the airline industry is people go through these cycles. I think we're caught in a perfect storm of, you know, faced by terrorism risks, post-election issues, and increased competition in our area at this time when we are refleeting. And what we've had to do is go back and say, what do we need to do to right-size the organization, and also how do we need to cut back to find the perfect balance between revenue and costs?
So how do you give confidence to your clients and tell them that Kenya Airways is still as strong as it used to be?
I think the fact that we already still, even in this difficult circumstances, still carry more than 10,000 people a day successfully right across Africa, the fact that we are still serving, the fact that we've refleeted and we have a new fleet that is serving the customer is a very strong proposition. We are, even in this difficult period, we launched Cape Town last week, which is a demonstration that we are not only sitting back and cutting back, we are also seeing how to improve where we fly. This year alone, we've increased frequencies, over 35 frequencies a week to our existing destination. Just reaffirms that we are still here and we are here for the long term.
Mbuvi Ngunze is the managing director and CEO of Kenyan Airways. He spoke with viewers Abdul Shakur Abud from the capital, Nairobi. The Electoral Commission of Zambia has suspended campaigns of all political parties in the capital, Lusaka, and Namwala, following rising tension and violence. Opposition Forum for Democracy and Development and the ruling Patriotic Front Party say the decision to suspend the campaigns is unfortunate and regrettable. But Priscilla Isaac, Director of Elections at the Electoral Commission, told me the electoral body has the constitutional mandate to change the campaign calendar before elections are held.
Well, it has arisen from the commission's growing concern with the violence, you know, the incidents of violence that seem to be on the increase, especially in Lusaka. And then in Namwala, we also had an incident where the FDD parliamentary candidate was injured through political violence. Her vehicle was damaged. Okay, the matter is in court, so there's yet a determination for the matter in court, but it was felt that there was not a fair and level playing field for that particular candidate because they were out of action and unable to campaign alongside with her colleagues since she had been injured. And then also in Lusaka, we had an unfortunate incident day before yesterday, which even resulted in the death of a young lady, which indeed is very regrettable.
The FDD said the decision by the Electoral Commission to suspend campaigns in both Lusaka and Namwala is illegal and that they will seek redress in court. What is the Commission's reaction to this?
Well, I'm not aware of that, but there is a provision under the law where we can amend the campaign timetable. And for us, that means that if there is a need, and there's even a provision in the law which provides that if we consider the environment not conducive for a free and fair election, we are at liberty to amend the election timetable, which includes the period for campaigns. And it is the commission that determines the campaign period. So we can actually cut short the campaign period if the commission is you know, makes a decision to do so. But of course, taking into account the issues on the ground. And if that is what FDD are saying, I'm surprised because they had written a letter of complaint to us saying that we're not taking any action to address their candidate being disadvantaged because they're unable to campaign.
Will the Electoral Commission be ready to meet the FDD? Because the spokesperson of the FDD said that they're going to court to challenge the decision of the Electoral Commission to suspend campaigns in both Namwala and Lusaka.
If they've decided to take the matter to court and we are party to the action, then of course we will respond to the issues in court. And it's not the first time that we are suspending campaigns. In Livingstone, when we postponed the by-election, we also suspended campaigns.
Will the suspension of the campaigns have any negative effect on the timetable of the election?
No, it still remains August 11. The election date is fixed in the Constitution. So even as a commission, we don't have the power to postpone a general election. The one that we have the power to postpone is a by-election, but not the general election, because the date is fixed in the Constitution, and it will not affect in terms of when campaigns end. They'll still end on the 10th of August at 18 hours, the day before the election.
So what is next following this action that the Electoral Commission has taken to suspend campaigns in both Namwala and Lusaka? When could it be possibly the suspension be lifted?
It's up to the 18th of it's up to the 18th of July, so they can campaigns can resume if the environment will be conducive from the 19th onwards.
Priscilla Isaac is the Director of Elections at the Electoral Commission of Zambia. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. And let's begin with football. Gabon is to name a new football coach on July 30th. This follows the sacking of their manager, Jose Costa, 6 months before hosting the Africa Cup of Nations. The Portuguese coach, hired in July 2014, was let go following the 2018 World Cup qualifying draw with Gabon in a tricky group alongside Ivory Coast, Mali, and Morocco. Costa was reportedly the best-paid manager of any national side on the continent. Gabon, who co-hosted the Cup of Nations in 2012 with Equatorial Guinea, staged the 2017 edition from January 21st to February 12th. Costa's successor is due to be named on July 30th in time for the first World Cup qualifiers in October. Meanwhile, Leicester City have signed Nigeria's international Ahmed Musa from CSKA Moscow on a 4-year contract for a club record fee of around £16 million. Musa joins the Premier League champions after helping CSKA win the Russian title. Southampton, Everton and West Ham were interested in the forward. Musa is Leicester's fourth signing of the summer after goalkeeper Ron Robert Zeller, defender Luis Hernandez and midfielder Nampaes Mbembe. Leicester's new signing joined CSKA in 2012 and scored 54 goals in 168 games and has scored 11 times in 58 appearances for Nigeria since making his debut in 2010. He scored twice in his country's 3-1 defeat by Argentina at the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, becoming the first Nigerian to score twice in a World Cup finals match. His first goal in that Group F game was his country's fastest at the tournament, coming after just 4 minutes. In athletics, Usain Bolt has allayed fears that he would miss the Olympics in Rio this summer by confirming his involvement in this month's London Anniversary Games. The six-time Olympic gold medalist pulled out of last weekend's Jamaican National Championships with a minor hamstring tear. Bolt is scheduled to race over 200 meters at the Olympic Stadium in London, where he has to prove his fitness to secure selection for Rio. The 100-meter and 200-meter world record holder sustained his injury, a grade 1 tear, during the first round of the 100 meters in Kingston and withdrew after winning his semi-final. If he does compete in Brazil this summer, he'll be aiming to complete an historic triple-double of 100 meters and 200 meters Olympic sprint titles, having won both in Beijing in 2008 and in London 4 years later. Finally, Euro 2016 comes to a climax at the Stade de France Sunday evening, where host France take on Portugal. In this Euro 2016 tournament, 50 matches have been played over 30 days with a total of 107 goals, 195 yellow and just 3 red cards, and we're now just waiting for a new European champion. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Yeah.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Couple done, love done.
Now you meet me, if I don't eat, we don't go eat, yeah. If I don't sleep, we don't go sleep, yeah. Couple done, one for left behind. Money done, done, one for left behind. If I don't get single, they be a me. Where we don't cook, we go cook a lot, yeah. Couple done, done, one for left behind. Money done, done, one for left behind. I say. This time one story about a girl I love her most, and she love me most, but things can change. Love can on this, and money done it. Like a sugar, money dead, we no go tire. Up and down, we go the pass. Then by them, we go jealous. Asa, could you imagine? I give you my 10,000 every day. Yeah. Then I pay me 310,000 for the money. That's couple done, love done. Now you meet me. If I don't eat, you no go eat. Don't go sleep, girl. Couple done, one for left behind. Money done, one for left behind. If I don't get single, they be a me. Where we don't cook, we go cook a lot, yeah. Couple done, one for left behind. Money done, one for left behind. I say. Love go, couple done, love go, go, love go, go. Couple done, love go, couple done, love go, couple done, love go, go, love go, go. Money day, Monday night, your love, Tuesday, salad, Wednesday, cow kanda, Thursday, chips, Friday night, Saturday, fufu, Sunday, love, water, but when money done, it done, done, yeah. Nothing, nothing. No, 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 yeah. Oh my God, oh life, hey. Now you meet me, if I don't eat, you no go eat, yeah. If I don't sleep, you no go sleep, yeah. Cup one and done, one for left. Money done, done, one for left behind. If I don't get single, they be a me. Where we don't cook, we go cook a lot, we do, yeah. One meat, couple done, one for left behind. Money done, done, one for left behind. I say, couple done, love will go. Couple done, love will go. Couple done, love will go. Love will go.
Toko so ikula, toko so insanswa, tole kinsamo. Aiko kiyomba, aiko kiyomba, aiko kiyomba. Robert le Bota, c'est le mofango pele mongo. A joli beta commando motote. Bokila lokondo. Banane loyo, banane loyo, kanga biro kona yo. Kende panabino, harite mini kapusia. Matata na bango ye, matata na bango balanza simizi ya siga ye tanga buto.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The expression Africa rising has become popular in some section of the media for about a year or two. And without penetrating analysis of the essence of that expression, some African leaders have embraced it, aimed at demonstrating that they have been competent managers of the country's economy. But really, what does it mean? Are we being told that Africa is on the march? If anything is that we can say the term may apply to the mining sector. True enough, when the mining sector is booming, growth rates are high, but do we also believe that trickle-down economy applies to these mining countries? Competent global economists have already debunked the idea of trickle-down, even in the industrial countries. If you take just one example, Sierra Leone was having a phenomenal growth rate when the mining companies were booming. But in the period of Ebola, many of these mining companies collapsed, the personnel left, and I think in one case, a company declared bankruptcy. And of course, the growth rate has depressed in Sierra Leone, and the economy is now in distress. But is it also a possibility that this expression, Africa rising, is an attempt to lull African leaders to sleep, to make them believe they are doing all right, and there is no need for them to turn to other pathways for development, for example, looking at China or India or Brazil? And the case of China is very tempting. A few years ago, this country was in deep poverty. Yet today, China has climbed out of that stage and is now the second functioning economy in the world next to the United States. China has been able to lift millions and millions of its people from poverty. Are we then being told that the best thing to do is to look to the Bretton Woods institutions and to follow the prescriptions that they have made, and there is no need to worry? I believe that African leaders and African economists should not be tempted, because we know that this expression does not apply to the millions of Africans who are still below the poverty level. Nor does it apply to the crumbling infrastructure of Africa, which has impeded intra-African trade, which is in fact an essence for economic development in Africa. Or even does it apply to the health sector in many African countries? As we saw in the Ebola case, the crumbling health sector made it very difficult to cope with that crisis. So the warning for Africa is, don't be misled by expressions which have no true meaning. have eminent economists like Professor Adedeji, who have written treaties about how best to proceed. Why don't we mobilize our economists for them to give us the true picture of our economy? Beware of false prophets. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline African team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Douglas Impuga, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, one's strength in conflict comes from one's verbal skills. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly supports entrepreneurship at home and abroad as a means to create not only prosperity, but peace and stability. Speaking at the Global Entrepreneurship Summit, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said, "Economic policy is foreign policy, and foreign policy is economic policy, particularly in the globalized world we're living in today." Secretary Kerry encouraged young people in particular to create new businesses, even if they started small. He urged young business owners to not only create new products and turn a profit, but as innovators and entrepreneurs with a stake in society, to also take on some of the societal challenges facing many countries. One of those challenges is violent extremism and the emergence of radical non-state actors who are out to exploit frustrations faced by many young people around the world. Indeed, in the Middle East, Africa, South Central, and East Asia, 60 to 65% of the populations are under the age of 30. These young people, said Secretary Kerry, need education and opportunity as soon as possible to keep them from being lured away by extremist ideologies. Successful new businesses provide inspiration to those who see no potential for improving their own circumstances. Speaking to young entrepreneurs, Secretary Kerry said, "You also provide a highly visible and very effective rebuttal to the propaganda of violent extremist groups, because your optimism provides an alternative to their nihilism, because you're trying to build the brighter future that in fact these folks are determined to prevent, because you are living a narrative of modern civilization and progress that is diametrically opposed to the dark worldview of Daesh." Another challenge for young entrepreneurs to take on is corruption. Anyone in local or international business confronts this issue every day in a variety of ways. For entrepreneurs, poor governance can mean the difference between being able to start up or survive, or never getting started at all. And there are countless ways that new entrepreneurs can help hold governments accountable. As Secretary Kerry emphasized, you want to be able to open your enterprises without having to pay a bribe or be dependent on making friends in high places. Being a global entrepreneur is about understanding and then using one's power to change the world. It's about leading the world toward a future of prosperity, peace, and progress.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.